Well, good afternoon, and welcome to the U.S. Institute of Peace. I hope everybody can hear me, including everybody way in the back. My name is Lynn Tesser. I'm a program officer here at the Institute, and I'll start out by thanking all of you for making your way over here on such a scorcher of a day. Hopefully it'll be one of the hottest of the summer, and hopefully there won't be too many more of them. The talk that you're about to hear is one of many of our project reports, and project reports provide current USIP senior fellows with an opportunity to present some of their research in progress. So it's my pleasure to introduce to everyone senior fellow Dana Eyre, who will be talking to us today about coalition democratization efforts in Iraq. Now, most recently, Dr. Eyre served as a senior advisor for USAID, serving in both Iraq and Washington. While in Iraq, he served as the USAID representative in the Coalition Provisional Authority's Office of Policy Planning and Analysis. And prior to this work, we're having trouble with the microphones in back? Oh, okay. If we can have someone look into that. I'll talk a little bit more loud than I'd like to until someone lets me know that the microphones are working, okay? Great. So to tell you a little bit more about Dr. Eyre's background, he's also served at the UN mission in Kosovo as the senior policy advisor to the deputy special representative of the Secretary General, as well as to the deputy head of the Economic Policy Office. He's also taught at the Lester B. Pearson Canadian International Peacekeeping Training Center and at the Naval Postgraduate School. Dr. Eyre holds a PhD in sociology from Stanford University. So we're absolutely delighted to have someone with Dr. Eyre's training and experience here to talk about such an interesting and important topic. Now, as many of you likely know, USIP has done a great deal of work on Iraq, most importantly under the auspices of our Iraq program. We've also published a number of special reports on Iraq. We've put a number of these out on our table out front, so I encourage you to take a look at these special reports. We have additional special reports that can be downloaded from our website, so please check those out. Now, in addition to this work, USIP also hosts the Iraq Study Group. The Iraq Study Group is a bipartisan effort led by James Baker and Lee Hamilton that aims to present. Are we on yet? Oh, not quite yet. We're getting there. Okay, so bear with me. So the Iraq Study Group is, again, a bipartisan effort led by James Baker and Lee Hamilton that aims to provide an independent assessment of the current and prospective situation in Iraq, the implications of the situation for the broader region, as well as for U.S. interests. Okay. Now, the next scheduled meeting of the Iraq Study Group is this afternoon, in fact, and while we'd love to have everyone stick around and make an afternoon of this, so to speak, the Iraq Study Group is a closed meeting. So we will unfortunately not be able to extend an invitation for you all today. Now, this event is scheduled to go until 2 o'clock, and at that point in time, we will ask everyone to leave the room rather quickly so that we can begin to prepare the room for the Iraq Study Group at 2:30, and once again, that is a closed event. Okay. Now, just a comment for the media present in the room. I'd like to remind you that the views of Dr. Eyre are not necessarily the views of the U.S. Institute of Peace. The Institute of Peace does not advocate for specific policies. Okay. Now, this event is being recorded and will also be made available on USIP website within a few days. So you don't need to take copious notes. You can listen to it once, twice, over and over again, as many times as you like. Okay. At this point in time, I'd like to officially thank Payam Mohseni, who is the young man sitting out at the table as you came in. Payam has done a great deal of work to make this event possible. Now, at this point in time, I don't think the mics are working yet,
but
we're still working on it. So Fortunately, neither one of us has laryngitis, so we should be okay. Now, at this point in time, I'd like to ask everyone to turn off their cell phones and Blackberries. I will warn you that if you do not, we'll have this kind of odd sound on the microphone system, so please turn them off now so you can save us from having to deal with this sound. Okay. Okay, so I think we're about ready to get started then. I'll turn the floor over to Dr. Ayer. He'll talk for approximately a half hour. Then we will open up the floor for questions and comments, and then, as I said before, ending sharply at 2. We'll try and end even sooner if there aren't a lot of questions. Okay? All right.
Lynn, thank you. You talked about listening multiple times. I'll be satisfied if everyone listens once, actually. It's traditional at this point to thank everyone at USIP for all of their help, but the fact that it's traditional doesn't mean that it's not heartfelt. I want to thank, besides all of USIP, Payam Mohseni, my research assistant, as well as my two previous ones, Mohammed Nasseri and Dominic DeSapio also, as well as Cheryl Brown and John Christ of the fellowship staff. Most particularly, I want to thank Lynn for her service as program officer, and also for obviously so doing such a good job in passing the rumor about the sandwiches and beer that come after the talk. Okay, I thought it was going to work as a joke, but that's okay. I also, though, particularly want to thank several friends with whom I've worked around the world in the Balkans and in Iraq and elsewhere. I have a great deal of appreciation to you for helping me develop what I'm going to be talking about. So those are the thank yous. Okay. I want to start out with a policy statement. I saw this exchange the other day, if you were watching C-SPAN, when Ambassador Khalilzad was briefing. These are not exactly quotes, but they capture the essence of what was said. And it struck me in listening that should I stay or should I go is not a particularly good policy debate. But more critically, it doesn't get to the core issue. Should I stay or should I go as a policy debate is all about me. It's all about what we should do. And in particular, only whether we should stay or whether we should go. It doesn't focus the discussion on what's going on in Iraq. In particular, it doesn't focus the discussion on the central issue, which is what are the political dynamics on the ground and what effect do we have on those political dynamics. Now, I mean, both of these individuals are well aware of that, and they're more than subtle in their own appreciation of these issues. But I think that we still need to grapple with both of these statements, and in particular how both of these statements can be true. I think implicitly we tend to see these as opposite ends of the spectrum, but both, in fact, can be true. I think we need to see where we are and what we can do to help stabilize the situation and move the situation forward, and also at the same time how we've become part of the problem. This paper is an attempt to grapple with the fundamental political processes going on in Iraq. It's also a little bit of an exercise because I'm going to be summarizing an ongoing book project. It's a little bit of an exercise in think along with Mitch, so I hope you'll be able to follow the bouncing ball as we go through the talk. Okay, what are we going to do? I want to first start out by identifying a problem that we didn't see and offer a way to understand it. And then I want to talk about some of the details of what I'm calling our operational failure in our democratization effort in Iraq. And then that will lead up to an assessment specifically of where we are and the implications for some of our policy choices going forward. Before I do that, though, before I turn to Iraq, I want to tell you a story about something that happened to me 25 years ago. A good friend of mine, Brian Hoey, was recently commissioned in the Air Force and had to go off to the basic course to begin his service. The week before he had to drive cross-country, he decided to rebuild the engine on his 1968 Volkswagen van. Brian is a very talented guy. He's a violinist. He's a speechwriter. He's a track and field athlete, but he is not a mechanic, and I am not a mechanic either. Luckily, there was a book How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive, a manual of step-by-step instructions for the complete idiot. I see a couple of nods that you know the book. Now, it has instructions in there like, before starting the next step, read the next paragraph completely twice and follow the instructions. And it says things like, unscrew the nuts and label them and put them in a plastic bag so you don't lose them. It really is a manual for the complete idiot. Now, it said you could drop an engine and reinstall it in 3 days if you followed the instructions. We obviously didn't follow them closely enough because we had a nightmare of missteps and mistakes. Ended up finishing the job 7 days later at 3 a.m. in the morning he had to depart. Now, there are three lessons that I draw from that experience. One, it's easier to take something apart than to put it back together. But once you've taken it apart, the only choice you have is what consequences you want to suffer. Two, there is a difference between a job being doable and knowing how to do it. And three, pay attention to the details of the process. Sequence, timing, details matter. And it's those last two messages, those last two lessons, the difference between a job being doable and knowing how to do it, and paying attention to process and sequence and timing and how things fit together, how things work together, that is the core of my critique. We are in Iraq today where we are not because the task was undoable, not because of inadequate troop levels, not because we didn't spend money fast enough, not because we didn't fix the electricity quick enough, or because of a lack of interagency coordination, though many of those things made things more difficult. The problem, we are where we are because we fundamentally failed to have an understanding of the central problem we faced, which is the dynamics of political mobilization, social change, and the fundamental social and political processes of democratization. And in turn, how we can shape those processes and how those processes are affected by the violent pursuit of political aims. And as I said already, this talk is schematic. It's an outline. It is designed to help us to shape the vocabulary that we use to think the problem through. It's not primarily, at this point, a definitive history of our effort or a specific work of policy analysis. I'm not saying, and I think it's important to note, that I'm not saying that Iraq is a failure. I'm saying the problems that we face in Iraq today are in significant part a consequence of how we went about doing what we did in Iraq. I should also note that this is not a criticism of General Garner, of Ambassador Bremer, or of anybody else who was there then or is there now, who has been working at the effort. This is Monday morning quarterbacking in the best sense. That is, it's a participant who's in the game, who wants to figure out what's going on and how to do it better. One of the things that amazes me as I've done interviews, I've talked with people about Iraq, and I've talked with people over there and when I was working over there, is how much as individuals we know. Every person I talk to has got a piece of the puzzle. Every person I talk to has got an aspect or a piece of understanding. We have not been able to bring that together, I think, because of coordination problems in the sense of we don't have the right people talking to each other and that kind of thing. But it is a lack of an overarching theory of what we're doing. Today in Iraq, we are going through a process ongoing in the middle of the conflict that's somewhat similar to the jointness revolution in the Department of Defense that came about after the Goldwater-Nichols Act. Now, the Goldwater-Nichols Act is well known, and there is a tendency to see that to believe that the Goldwater-Nichols Act drove the jointness revolution. What I want to argue, or what I've argued elsewhere, is that it is actually the evolution of a theory of warfare. It was the United States military thinking through what it was doing that then enabled the success of the Goldwater-Nichols Act. That was the first thing that we had to have was a theory of warfare that we could then follow up with an organizational pattern or an organizational change. We today don't have that theory, that fundamental theory of victory of what we're doing in Iraq, and that's what I want to talk about, or that's what I'm working to develop. Now, I want to start out with the problem that we didn't understand. Clausewitz, not quite 200 years ago, wrote, "The first, the supreme, the most far-reaching act of judgment that the statesman and the commander has to make is to establish the kind of war on which they are embarking." I think Drew Erdman's comments speak to the disappearance of what sociologists call gnomic instrumentalities. And gnomic instrumentalities is an awkward word that explains why so few sociologists get invited to TV talk shows, but it's a very clear idea, in fact. Gnomic instrumentalities, or sometimes called social institutions, are socially constructed realities that we use to order our lives. A $20 bill or the idea of the state. I mean, if you can imagine the Republican Party without the state and big government to rail against, or if you can imagine Democrats without the Republican Party, you have a sense of how gnomic instrumentalities, social institutions, order our lives. Gnomic instrumentalities are landmarks of social life. We can like them, we can dislike them, but they're the rivers and mountains of social terrain. That is, we all act as if the thing is real, and it is. And it is that mutual process of all of us acting as if this thing is real that constructs it. The state, money, and ethnic groups are all good examples of gnomic instrumentalities. And if you think about how money works very briefly, it works. If I pull a $20 bill out of my pocket, you all think it's a $20 bill. I can go over and buy a Coke with it. Therefore, and I think it's worthwhile because the vendor across the street acts like it's worthwhile, and he acts like it's worthwhile because he can take it and buy something else with it. And so it is a reality, but money is a socially constructed reality. And what we also see with money is when we see the phenomenon of hyperinflation, what happens is people stop believing in money. Well, what happened when Saddam Hussein went away was people stopped believing in the state. A central ordering principle of reality, of life in Iraq, went away. And again, as with Republicans and the government, or Democrats and Republicans, it's not a question of whether you like something or not. It is the fact that its socially constructed existence is there that allows you to order your life. Now, we missed this problem. We never fully grasped it, and we never fully grasped the implications of it. And my argument proceeds from this central point. I should point out that the Future of Iraq project did anticipate the problem. They wrote, "The Iraqi body politic outside of the Kurdish regions will find itself the day after the fall of the regime formless and atomized." Now, formless and atomized is a little bit of an exaggeration, but it does at least capture that reality of saying, look, when this thing falls down, people are not going to quite understand what's going on. Okay. Now, and this process is linked intimately to politics. A second view of the problem that we didn't understand. If you're in the back, it says, we should go over there and see if anyone is ready for democracy when they stop to reload. Now, the cartoon is a simplification in two ways. First, it's all about shooters, people with guns. It doesn't depict those without guns, the spectators, if you will, the audience. The two GIs in the foxhole are asking if when they stop shooting, they go over there and see if anyone's ready for democracy. It implies two things. It implies a choice between shooting and democracy, and that there are two organized sides. I think that's as I said, that's a simplification. In April or May of 2003, there were about 250, 300,000, 400,000 people in Iraq who unambiguously, undoubtedly stood for the coalition democratization effort. Most of them were wearing camouflage and had a flag on their sleeve. And then there were about 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 equally dedicated folks on the other side. Those are the folks that would later become known as former regime elements and Sunni Arab rejectionists and stuff like that. And then in the middle, there were about 24 or 25 million Iraqis, some of whom might have been well disposed towards the democratization effort, some of them might have been a bit disinclined, but for all of whom, the central question was, what's next? What happens now, and what do we do now? And it is that gap, that failure to understand this problem, the problem of the state disappearing, the problem of 25 million people wondering what's going on and what's next, that is at the core problem we've missed. We viewed nation building, we viewed democratization and conflict transformation, not focused on process or partnership, but on end state. And that's a little bit like building a house by looking at a picture of a house, and maybe a picture of a bathroom and a picture of a bedroom or something like that, but without having an understanding that the first thing you do when you build a house is you lay a foundation, and then you build the frame, and then you put the roof on, and then you can do your interior carpentry, and without understanding that a house is actually something that people live in. Outcome is important, but process is the way we get there. And to sum up, is this picture. For Fulan al-Fulani, the average Iraqi, the late spring of 2003 was a confusing time, with lots of questions and fundamental choices. What's happening? What do I do now? Who can I trust? How do I survive? Democratization and the state are abstract concepts. The advantages of democracy are not immediately apparent. Being a citizen requires change. It's a new game, a new form of behavior, and the rules need to be learned and practiced. You can take a baseball player and train him to be a soccer player, but you can't do it without practice and instruction. Now, a very brief comment, and the paper goes into more detail on this, on the social structure in Iraq. We sometimes hear people make comparisons to the former Yugoslavia, talk about, which is kind of a variant on ethno-sectarian essentialism. And I want to say, just very briefly before moving on, Iraq was not fated for ethno-sectarian conflict that we now see or now are on the verge of, nor for that matter was the former Yugoslavia. But I think that's an important point to note. The average Iraqi was worried about survival, but also about the future and his or her place in it. The average Iraqi was distracted with a lot of questions, yet what we understand is without the support of Fulan al-Fulani, the average Iraqi, we can't win. Solving this problem is the essence of the democratization campaign. My argument is that we lost this critical battle to engage the average Iraqi, to mobilize him or her to motivated, aware action. Failure, particularly when it's highlighted in red, might be a controversial word, but I'm using the phrase operational failure in a very specific way. We tried very hard. We did lots of stuff right, and we had real successes, but we're clearly not where we want to be, not by a long shot. Now, the operational level is a little bit of military jargon. It's that level between fundamental decisions about strategic goals and the tactical level of individual bits and pieces and individual programs. And that's the failure that we had. If you're a military historian, the Cohen and Gooch's analysis talks about the anti-submarine warfare campaign in the early World War II, or Gallipoli as examples of operational failure. They talk about the critical concept for us, though, is the concept of a lost victory. That is, an operational failure is an opportunity that is not seized, is a failure as well. And I think our democratization campaign was such a lost victory. It's not a failure by an absence of effort. We did lots of good things. We had lots of good bits and pieces. But again, back to the story that I told at the opening, it is a question of how things fit together, of sequence, of level of effort, and timing that we didn't get right. And what we did has made our current problem more difficult. Now, I should say in war, the other side has a say as well. We are where we are, not just because of what we did, but because of what those who oppose us did as well. But we made their job easier for them. Okay. Now, to back up just a moment, Fulan al-Fulani really has three choices in 2003. We want Fulan to pick citizenship, to come into the public sphere, to actively understand and engage in the state, in the democratization process, and in the community. The anti-democratic elements obviously want the choice of polarization, you know, to support their faction, to support non-state and obstructionist elements. And that the one that is unfortunately most natural and also serves the anti-democratic cause is withdrawal. I mean, the problem is, as I noted earlier, that citizenship is risky. It's a new behavior. It's also not just an individual behavior. It's also a social behavior. That is a behavior that has to be worked out amongst individuals. The advantages aren't clear, and the process of building that behavior needs to be worked out. That's very difficult coming out of the 30 years in the Republic of Fear, and it's not necessarily even an obvious problem, without the trajectory of coming out of the Republic of Fear. Now, the requirements for the obstructionists are easier than the requirements to build citizenship. All they have to do is drive people out, cause them not to act, cause them merely not to become citizens, just to stay at home. And, of course, the obstructionists have a lot of practical advantages as well. Recruiting young, bored, unemployed, frustrated males for a cause that promises, in the short run, glamour, excitement, meaning, eternal salvation, and immediate pecuniary reward is easier than recruiting for a long, hard slog with reality. And at the same time, terrorists only need to recruit a relatively small number of individuals to cause large amounts of chaos. You assume about 15 million adult population within Iraq. The anti-democratic forces only need to recruit 0.1% of the population to have 15,000 people ready to cause mayhem. They only need to recruit 2% of the population to have 300,000 supporters. So that the anti-democratic forces have some relatively robust advantages. How do we overcome those? How do we build citizenship? It's not easy. It's not just a matter of rebuilding the electricity or giving somebody a temporary job and assuming they'll sign on. Maslow's hierarchy of needs as an idea has done us more damage in Iraq than any other idea. People are more complicated than that, and democratization is a social process. So how do we develop it? It's like the joke about the person who asked, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? And was answered, practice. There is a process for getting through democratization. Now, this illustration illustrates a little bit abstract, but it's actually a very straightforward process. You have to have a game to play. You have to have a structure to participate in. Structure is a precondition for a democratic process. Once you have that structure, then you can participate. Once you start to participate, if you're participating in a decision or a process that affects something that you care about, then you're naturally motivated to continue to participate. And if people are then explaining to you what you're doing and why and how the process works, then you get a cycle that can reinforce itself. President Bush is exactly right when he talks about the time it took to get American democracy right. But what I argue is that the critical time wasn't the time after the Constitution, but rather it was the time before the Constitution, when America's founding fathers, using the structure of colonial government that was imposed by the British Empire, built the foundation of our democracy. We built the social structures, we built the understanding, the networks, the coalitions that enabled the creation of American democracy. If you want a contemporary example, just look at the role of megachurches in the Republican Party as a structure which enables participation, which enables understanding, which enables a process of political mobilization. Now, perhaps, I mean, in a situation like Iraq, what this means is the essence of a democratization effort during conflict transformation effort is the undemocratic management of a process that leads step by step through increasingly representative and democratic steps to a genuine democracy. I argue that we failed to provide sufficient structure, that is, an enabling structure, that we in turn failed to enable meaningful participation and to reinforce that participation appropriately. Now, using this basic framework, I'm going to talk about the coalition effort at two levels. One, at the national level, looking at our military strategy, our political strategy, our economic strategy, and then I'll drop down and talk about the democratization strategy. You might be a bit skeptical, and you said, we had a lot of plans, we had a lot of ideas. How come our national military strategy, our national political strategy, our national economic strategy didn't provide the structure that you say we needed? Well, I think the essence of that answer lies in the nature of those strategies. The national military strategy has been unkindly, although not necessarily inaccurately, called whack-a-mole. That is, like that old game where the mole pops up, you run over there and you whack it. You go over to Tal Afar and you whack it. You go over to Fallujah and you whack it. You go over to Ramadi and whack it. You go down to Najaf and you whack it. And you run all over the place focused on the bad guy, not focused on anything else. Now, that has evolved. We'll come to that in a moment. But that was the strategy in the period I'm particularly focusing on. Our national economic strategy was, again, a national strategy focused on economic reform, focused on privatization, focused on major infrastructure and that kind of activity. And our national political strategy was, again, focused on the national level, on the governing council, on the constitutional process, and on national activities. The problem was that from the point of view of Fulani al-Fulani, these three national strategies never aligned, never connected, never delivered either specific security, political, or economic structure order to any given Iraqi at any particular point in time. Now, sometimes they did connect, but as an overall structure, they didn't, and they didn't necessarily at any given point in time. So that, in essence, we are saying to Fulani al-Fulani, who asks, where's my country going, what's happening, we said, come back in 3 years, trust me, you'll like it. And when a contractor says that on my house, I get nervous. Now, I'm convinced we were right. That is, you know, this is not a question of whether democracy and market economies is the right answer. It's the question of of the process and how the process affects the people who are living in the house while you're remodeling it, which is the essence of this. They're not going on vacation for 3 years. They're living there, and fundamentally a house is not a nation. A nation is not a house. Now, the reality and going forward in talking about this these decisions and in future the decisions I'll talk about next, I want to emphasize this is not a criticism of any specific decision, but rather it's an assessment of how decisions and actions, when combined together, have certain effects. The problem is basically a little bit like drug interaction. If you go to two doctors and you don't tell them what the other doctor is prescribing, you can get yourself in real trouble because of the effects of one action and the way they interact with the effects of other actions. And so this is a critique that is focused on that interactive process and the way that interactive process worked. Okay. I said we have to structure, we have to have participation, and then we have to reinforce with both information and interest. How well did we do structuring? Not so well. Okay, on the 4th of April of 2003, we said Iraqis will be developing the interim authority at various stages of the process. I probably, if I edited that sentence for a couple of hours, could get something a little bit more vague than that. I could probably take out the word Iraqi, but other than that, interim authority at various stages of the process is a pretty vague roadmap for what's going to happen. Now, when the governing council was announced, what was the question? How did they get picked? And then, again, from the point of view of Fulani al-Fulani, who were these people? How did they get chosen? How do they represent me? What's their role? So the selection process, the ambiguity of the authority, the power, and the role of the GC, and the presence of exiles all combine to a very kind of problematic role for the governing council that doesn't provide a clear structure to build around. I should make my comment on the role of exiles. I'm not saying that exiles are inappropriate in a situation like this. It's just a very straightforward sociological analysis. We've seen it in South Africa and we've seen it elsewhere. When exiles are engaged in a political process, by the nature of the exile experience, attitudes are different, networks are different, and so exiles participating in a process change the process. And given the isolation of Iraq, that effect was magnified. Now, there is an irony. What about the TAL? What about the transitional administrative law process? Imagine the point of view, again, of an Iraqi engineer or a farmer or a businessman who wants to participate. Orha said Iraqis will be developing the interim authority at various stages of the process. Where do I show up? Okay, that's not too clear. CPA comes along on the 8th of September and says, it's the governing council. The governing council is going to form a preparatory committee, and they're going to write the constitution. That lasted about 2 months until the November 15th agreement. The November 15th agreement said, we'll get back to you. We're not going to do what we said we are. We're not quite sure what it is, but we'll make a further announcement, and it's going to be a different process. Okay. Then somewhere in the middle of December, there was another announcement, and then the transitional administrative law came out, and the transitional administrative law laid out a process, and the first step was for an interim government, and that interim government was going to be selected by caucuses, and the Iraqis said, caucus? What's a caucus? And then we said, well, never mind, it's not going to be a caucus. It's going to be picked by us again, and then it's going to be picked by the UN, and Lakhdar Brahimi comes in. So again, the point is, again, not that these individual decisions, in these environments, one is faced with a choice between bad and worse options, but it's the way in which a sequence of decisions and a sequence of activities has a net effect. The irony of what the U.S. did decide, that is, the U.S. was very clear and definitive in saying, in establishing a structure, there are going to be no elections. We are going to pick representative individuals. The irony of that was we ended up giving an issue to the Shia majority population, which understood two things about democracy. You get to vote, and the majority wins. And that's not necessarily a bad idea in a two-sentence summary. But when you say, so what we did was we created, in the structure that we created an issue to unify the very group whose unity and dominance we were afraid of, because we were afraid of, in part, Iranian influence and that kind of thing. At the subnational level, we didn't exactly cover ourselves in glory in terms of the local governance program. It was a big program. What it ended up doing was having to surge out and spend a lot of money very quickly to get out into the provinces, because Orha came in with regional representatives. It didn't come in with provincial representatives. So the local governance program ended up doing a de facto job as the CPA's representatives. The last official CPA representatives didn't show up until October or November. I think it was October of 2003, 6 months after we were there. That meant the local governance program spent a lot of money very quickly because the security situation was getting bad. It ended up spending a lot of money on security in April 2004 because it was out and it was in individual compounds outside of the CPA compounds, and during when the security situation went very bad in April 2004, it had to pull back. Then the CPA transitioned to state. State pulled back, and what that meant was collectively through all of that process, the local government development effort was weakened as well. The final piece I'll just mention quickly is Sunni disenfranchisement, in that we did not necessarily mean that the disestablishment of the army or the debathification would be a message of disenfranchisement, but everybody's got a cousin, and the message was clearly read that way. So what's the net result in terms of our structuring? We don't have a center, we don't have local government, and we've handed two issues to unify the Shia majority and the Sunni population. Now, participation, to be worthwhile, has to be meaningful. You're all here participating, either because you're a friend of mine and you know I'll be taking notes on who was here, or because it connects to something you care about, or because of the free lunch rumor or something like that. But participation has to be meaningful. Now, grounded in the principles of adult education, this means it can get summed up as the phrase, adults learn on a need-to-know basis. So participation, to build political engagement, has to be linked to something meaningful. It's got to be multiple and reinforcing. You don't learn. You have to, again, practice is a repetitive process. It's got to be engaging and active. It's not just an abstract idea. It's not just something that a scholar has in the head, but it's a learned set of skills that link to behaviors and that kind of thing. So people have to process, and it's also a collective process. It is, again, democracy, but also just basic learning is something that happens together. Now, we did, again, the basic story is very similar. We did lots of good things, a bit disconnected, not quite fitting together. We had lots of town hall meetings, but unlike real town hall meetings where you go because you care about the issue in front of you, I was flipping along on the Fairfax Channel, and there was some, God love me, it's like, 16-year-old earnest kid like me, years ago, talking about one of these mega churches that was going to build a big church in his neighborhood and it was going to change the character of his neighborhood. He was participating because he cared about that process. Now, when we did have lots of town hall meetings, I saw one down in Basra that was particularly notable. People, because we were concerned about people's willingness to speak up, we had them write the questions down on cards and hand them in. And they went, and the governor was there, and we were all excited that the governor was there. The first question comes up, and the translator's sitting next to me, and he says, the question is, when is the governor going to be elected? The governor reads the question, and he puts it down, and he goes to the next card. When is the governor going to be elected? He puts it down. So that was not a town hall meeting. That was about what the people cared about, at least in those first two questions. We had a civic education program that was not linked to and died just a little bit before the actual constitutional development program. We had a civil society development, which was a great program focused on civil society development, building the capacity of existing organizations, farmers, unions, lawyers, associations, and things like that. Got started at the end of 2004 and just barely running into 2005. So again, late to connect to the constitutional process. We had a variety of other, and I can go into some more detail, but again, the basic logic is participation not connected to meaningful processes, not connected, not reinforcing. The final bits and pieces in terms of our democratization strategy, I'll give you a phrase in terms of how we on our economic program. I was talking with an engineer who said, I don't do politics, I'm an engineer, I build things. When you spend $18 billion, whether you like it or not, you're doing politics. And who you give the decision about how to spend that money to is empowered by that decision. Now, one of the things I didn't mention was, of course, the fragmentation of the ministries that our transitional process gave, but we fragmented, changed ministers. It was very difficult to link the spending because of the nature of our democratization plan and our efforts. It was very difficult to link decisions about spending to the democratization process, which disempowers the democratization process. In terms of information or strategic communications, we had a real tendency to think strategic communication, it's all about me, right? That is, we spent an awful lot of time saying, no, trust us, we're doing lots of good things for you. And we were. But the point of strategic communications is not to generate love and affection, but to facilitate the effort. That is to change, to be a part of the change process. And I think that was the major mistake that we had there. Okay, so that's the critique of what we did. Where are we now? And I want to come back to this. Now, we're all familiar with the bad news, so I won't review the bad news. But the good news is, first off, I don't want to minimize the achievement of what we've got. An elected Iraqi government is an imperfect thing, but it is a very real achievement. I think we have changed to clear, hold, build the strategy that Ambassador Khalilzad has successfully promulgated, and I think that's a change in the right direction. Injury time. Well, we all understand, you know, nobody's quite sure how much time the ref is going to add to the clock in injury time. Are we in injury time yet? Are we getting there close? Well, the past couple of days have not exactly added time to the clock for us. So I don't think that we have seen polarization and the spread of fear and the spread of civil war to the degree that it's not recoverable, but we're clearly in or getting very close to injury time. In terms of my trilogy of withdrawal, citizenship, and polarization, withdrawal clearly has become the most popular and citizenship the most problematic. The good news is, and I want to talk a little bit about it, is polarization is not quite as bad as we might expect. I've been reading some public opinion research recently and focus groups and things like that are specifically on these issues. And the situation is, first off, in terms of polarization, connection remains between Sunni and Shia, and the situation is not radically polarized. There are soft edges and connections between these two groups. Prior Iraqi life, in which Sunni and Shia lived together and were connected and were part of the same tribe and were part of the same community, has not gone away. There is also a willingness to recognize each other's positions and a willingness to recognize each other's fears and each other's concern. That is a fundamentally good thing because the process of polarization has not gone so far ahead that we are stuck with this is not Bosnia in 1994. The polarization process has not gone that far ahead. There is also ambivalence about militias, and that's the purple question marks there. Even those who are that are ethno-sectarian aligned, the Sunni and Shia each are ambivalent about the militias that are aligned on their own side. So that Shia are ambivalent about the Jaish al-Mahdi, the Sadr militia. Sunni are ambivalent about the militias on their side. There is a fairly broad recognition that there are no good militias because they don't obey the law. Militias are not the correct solution to the problem. They recognize gang activity in militias. They recognize self-interest in militias. And they recognize militias don't really respond to a chain of command, right? That they're kind of problematic in that regard. So that is, I think, spectacularly good news in terms of the degree of polarization. Now, each side sees more justice in its claims than in the claims of the others, even though it recognizes it. So the Sunni tend to see the Jaish al-Mahdi as low-class criminals, and that's a quote, whereas the Shia tend to see the Sunni militias as shadowy and kind of uncertain. And there's kind of an interesting parallel there, particularly in terms of the religious differences, the cultural differences there. But even so, there is reluctance, so that there is a recognition that particularly on the part of the Sunni, that the Shia militias are defensive. The Shia claim their own militias as defensive. The Sunni tend to see the Jaish al-Mahdi as low-class criminals. The Shia tend to see the Sunni militias as shadowy. And the Sunni, of course, tend to see their militias as resistance and therefore legitimate. So I mean, but again, that there is ambivalence about the fundamental nature of them. The government of Iraq is distant. Obviously, it's more aligned with and more supported by the Shia community. There's a good deal of a rising suspicion about government forces, about alignment. That little thin line between the Sunni and government there represents the fact that the Sunni do want government. It is they want a functional government, and they want the government of Iraq to function. Okay, so that's the assessment in terms of polarization. Implications for the way ahead. First, in terms of U.S. military strategy, I disagree with Stephen Biddle's communal war argument, the argument that was recently laid out in Foreign Affairs in the looking at Baghdad, seeing Saigon argument. He suggests that we've made a category mistake. We've said people's war. We think it's people war when it's really a communal war. I think Biddle is making an ontological mistake, that is a mistake about what the meaning of is. Iraq is its own thing. It's not yet, it isn't Bosnia, it isn't Yugoslavia, it isn't yet a communal war. Iraq is its own thing. In terms of the military strategy also, sometimes you hear people saying things like, well, we've got to do the big M strategy and then we're going to do the big C strategy. And what this analysis says is you have to integrate military and civilian strategies. I think clear, hold, build is the right way. I think we really have to think about the consequences of Iraqi security force training. And that really links to the civil war settlement issue. The classic problem in civil war settlement is not the actual settlement. It's not what the document says the solution is. It's the guarantee of the settlement. What we have is a nascent developing civil war. You know, we're quibbling on the margins. Well, yes, there are 1,000 people killed a year, but it's not as bad as it could be. Therefore, it is, but it is not a civil war. It is its own thing. But I think the insights from civil war settlement theory that we need to think through the problem of guarantee of settlement is a very important one. That speaks to the importance of governance development. That is, the Iraqi state has to be able to function in part as a guarantor of the settlement, but I think the state is a long way away from doing that. So therefore, we have to think about third-party guarantee roles. That doesn't necessarily mean the blue helmets coming in, but we do have to think about the problem of third-party guarantee. If you saw, I'm not sure whether it was the Times or the Post this morning, but there was an interesting article that kind of confirmed some of the things that I had picked up earlier, which is there are some Sunni who are asking for the U.S. to stay basically in that third-party guarantor role. In terms of security sector reform, that ties to the civil war settlement problem. tackling the militias right now, given the degree to which both sides, even though they're ambivalent about the militia, are also very defensive and view them as just for their own perspective. I'm not sure taking down the militias, eliminating the militias, is the right thing to do. We may want to think about using either the Bosnia or the Kosovo models. In Bosnia, you'll recall, we did the 5-3-2 settlement. That is, we actually structured the military forces of Bosnia in a way to affect the military balance of power. We might want to do that internally within the state. The other thing that we did in Kosovo was we took the Kosovo Liberation Army and turned it into the Kosovo Protection Corps. And that has two advantages. One, it's a disarmament and demobilization process. The other is, if you have lions and tigers and bears, it's a good thing to keep them in a zoo. And the Kosovo Protection Corps served as that. Okay. So there are lots more implications. What I'll leave you with, though, are these quotes. A colleague of mine, Peter Schaefer, pointed out in a conversation several months ago that the Founding Fathers understood democracy. They understood democracy, they understood people, they understood social processes well enough to invent our democracy as a practical thing. We know how to live in it, but because we've lived in it, because it has become an institution for over 200 years, we've forgotten about the fundamental process of building the democracy. I think these two quotes are quite interesting. And I think I would leave you with the concluding thought that nation building, it seems, requires the participation of the nation. Thank you.
Okay, we've got about a half hour for questions and comments. We're going to start with the folks at the table. There are microphones around the table. Start with a few questions around the table, then we'll open it up to the folks in back, and we've got a microphone over to the side. Hopefully that's still turned on. So again, we've got a half hour. Please try and make your questions and comments brief, and also identify yourself before you speak, or as you start. And let's start with the two gentlemen over here.
Don Hayes from USIP. One of the comments that I like to refer to with regard to Bosnia is Colin Powell's comment to the president when he said, if you break it, you own it. This is certainly relevant to all peacekeeping missions in which you have to use force to create the peace. The problem, it seems to me, in Iraq as well as in other missions, is once you own it, how do you transfer it? And we don't seem to have figured this out. And partly because we've missed this grassroots-up civic process. How do you propose that we change our mindset on this?
Okay, how do we change the mindset? I think the first thing we have to do is we have to recognize that there is this process that these things have to be built. We've thought about these processes as purely technical ones. Well, in order to have a government, I've got to have accountants, and I got to have lawyers, and I got to have, you know, technical things. We have to recognize that those things only make sense within a social context. I think that's one statement. I think buy the book in 18 months, and I'll be a full answer to that. I think because that's a very complicated question. The other thing, though, that I have to say is that, you know, the you break it, you buy it kind of metaphor. The reality of these is that what we have is both two parties, both of whom, for whatever reason, have a legitimate interest in the process. We have an interest in the stability of Iraq. Now, you know, whether we should have been there or not, we're there now. We have a legitimate interest that we can argue. We have, and Iraqi. So it is a problem in co-ownership. And how we structure processes of transition, recognizing that reality of co-ownership. There's a lot to be worked out in terms of how we do it. I think the first step is just recognizing that we need to think differently about the process.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. Your first quote, the one from Clausewitz, you know, the first thing you need to know is the kind of war on which you've embarked. 1812, Napoleon invaded Russia, crushed the Russian army, made it to Moscow, and basically said, I will bring you democracy, overthrow the Tsar, and bring you. The city burned. He had to retreat. Was his failure democratization, or was it his inability to understand the nature of the war on which he had embarked? And is, you know, is where I'm going.
I think that I use that quote. I read war in there, and kind of in the same way that jihad is read in two levels. One is a larger struggle. And an individual struggle, and also in the specific sense of a conflict. I think what the Clausewitz quote speaks to me is that the question of understanding the fundamental problem we have set in front of ourselves. And I think that in that sense, I mean, I work within an intellectual framework that talks about conflict transformation, the transformation of violent conflict into nonviolent political conflict. I think the vocabulary of war brings with it a whole range of ideas about victory and defeat. When what we want in the war in a variety of situations is for the place to function halfway decently. So I use that Clausewitz quote in that sense of saying, look, understand the fundamental problem that we have set in front of us. And I think we did not understand the fundamental problem of democratization.
Okay, then let's have these two gentlemen in the back. Is there someone over?
My name's Dan Lieberman. As far as I know, we're building huge bases, permanent bases, in Iraq, and we have the largest embassy of all our embassies in one of the smallest countries of the world. So it seems to me when we say we're leaving, we need a definition of that word. And it seems that what we're doing in staying with these huge bases is even worse than occupation, that we'll be facing something worse than our present occupation.
When I was working in Kosovo, I had a French boss when I was the deputy head of the economic policy office, and he was a very typical Frenchman. He's very suspicious of what the Americans were doing, and he used to go down to Bonsteel, and he said, "This is a strategic deployment base," and it's Bonsteel is huge in Kosovo. I mean, and the U.S. basically took a hilltop and built an enormous base. At the time, I think it probably has 10,000, 15,000 folks. And I couldn't convince him that, you know, basically the American Army likes to build stuff, and it's good at building stuff, and it's got money to build stuff, and there's a variety of processes. So I think, you know, the bases in the embassy can be understood. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't some long-term plan. There may very well be, but it can also be understood as just, you know, bureaucratic decision makers making the safe bureaucratic decision not to be. The last thing that the diplomatic security wants to do is get blamed for not building an embassy which is big enough or safe enough for what we might need. I completely agree, though, that the way we are handling, right, again, whether the individual decision is right or wrong, the way we are handling the question of our long-term presence there has consequences in terms of the internal Iraqi perception of the U.S. role there. I mean, that's very clear. You see it in the focus groups. You see it in the public opinion polls. So the question then is, if there's some reason that we can't address the question of leaving, how do we mitigate that? How do we manage that? Because it clearly is having an effect in terms of the democratization process and in terms of the attitudes of Iraqis towards the United States.
This gentleman and the lady in the corner, and then after these two give their questions, we'll go to the back, and if I can ask you to go over to the side and speak into the microphone, as I said before, hopefully it's on, so please get ready to pose your questions.
Hi, thanks. My name's Russ Webster. I work for DAI. And Dane, I want to start off by thanking you for your presentation, because I think you highlight a critical missing part of this whole process, and that is trying to give vision to the people who are going to have to live in the house. I think one of the challenges of democracy, particularly democracy as we know it here in the U.S., is that leadership, and I think you see this playing out in Iraq, whether they're elected or not, they may pay lip service to certain things like representation, constituency, mandates, and accountability, but I think in their heart of hearts, they really do believe they're philosopher kings, and that, in fact, just the fact that they were elected was an endorsement that they know how to run things better than the common person on the street. And so what they do is they sort of peck away at the margins of the process to try to control what they really want to control, and that's the outcome, and pretty much do whatever they can do to get away with that. And I think you see that playing out in the examples you gave earlier about the process in Iraq. So my question then is, could we turn away for a moment from the U.S. experience, which I think is, as we know it today, so structured and to the point where people can sort of self-select their level of participation. And have you in your research highlighted any social experiences, whether they're contemporary or past, that you would perhaps show as a better vision, a better example of how to get this kind of process underway in Iraq?
No, disappointingly no, but I haven't been looking for successes. I mean, I've been the project thus far has been focused on understanding what we did in Iraq.
Sure.
I think there are lots of, particularly at the level of social movements, I mean, there are lots of successful social movements that serve as intermediate level, you know, I mean, tree planting activities in Kenya to local government efforts. I mean, so we've got lots of operational level examples, but I haven't found kind of the mission level example yet. But it also, I mean, this is, you know, in many respects, this may be a little bit, there are lots of bits and pieces out there, but no, I haven't found a single good unifying example yet.
I guess for me the practical question is, getting back to your description of the fellow on the street who's asking the questions,
Yeah. What
would we want to say to him in terms of vision? And I think that's a real major shortfall, and I appreciate that you highlighted that in your work.
Yeah, no, and I think that the answer is that we have got to be able to say, look, we don't know all of the things. What we do know is we do bring some unique ideas and we do bring some abilities. So how do we work together? I mean, the core message back to Fulano Fulani in the street is, no, we don't have all the answers. We've got some of the answers, and you've got some of the answers, so let's figure out how to get our answers together. So that's the overarching approach. But no, the finding better examples is one of the many next steps.
Hi, my name is Rahab. I'm an intern at Cato, and I'm from Iraq. There's just one thing that I really don't understand about the political process in Iraq. Is that now we say the biggest achievement is that, like, there's a unity government, and in the past there was no unity government. But how can we say there is a unity government when each political party has its own militia that carries out armed attacks and terrorizes the people? Like me as a citizen, I would prefer not to have unity government but to live in peace than to having all these political people who fight each other, and the only people who are paying the price are the Iraqi civilians.
There's only one thing you don't understand about governance in Iraq. You're doing very well. No, I agree. I mean, unity government is one of those phrases like bipartisanship, right? I mean, people, you say bipartisanship, but that doesn't mean partisanship goes away. I personally am unapologetically partisan. I think it's not because I think my particular party or my particular political position is right. It's because I have a view of the process which says, You have to have partisanship to work out ideas and also to establish accountability. So I think the challenge and the advantage of the so-called unity government is it does reinforce what is already there and what is very strong, which is Iraqi identity. It says it is an effort to say we Iraqis will stay united. We will determine the future of Iraq, and so in that sense, it's a positive thing. But you're exactly right. The existence of militias does functionally undercut the ability of that to do it. And I mean, part of the one advantage of the unity government at this stage is that as a result of, I think, in large part, or at least in significant part, the way we went about democratization, the vote ended up being, in essence, an ethnic census with some things on the side. And so in the face of a vote that was essentially an ethno-sectarian census, then a unity government is a very important message, right? It says, even though we voted that way, it's really less important than national unity and Iraqi identity. But the difficulties of it, and particularly the difficulties of a unity government with the militias, are you're exactly right.
Okay, great. Let's go to the back now.
Hi, Betty Sitka from the American University Center for Global Peace. Thank you for your talk. Again, I also thought you made some very interesting analyses and put it into very useful format. And with less time today on the implications for the way forward, although I'm sure you've got more thoughts on that. So I have two quick questions. One is, on your implications for the way forward, is anybody in the administration actually listening to you? Because our experience is that it's a very, very closed loop. And while we're talking about some ideas and ways of readjusting understandings that will hopefully help for on the ground, the folks that I know who are trying to pass on information are not getting it through. So that's my first question. And the other question is, you said that this is not Bosnia, but a week or so ago we just had lunch with somebody from Basra who said that, you know, they were given 7 days to leave the city, or they couldn't assure their safety. So it certainly sounds like, you know, ethnic.
Yeah. Is anybody listening? I don't know. One can hope. In terms of it, it's not yet Bosnia, right? Mm-hmm. And I made that comment about Bosnia wasn't Bosnia in the sense that, you know, if we, as you know, I mean, it's there was a process of ethnic polarization. There was a process of neighbor turning against neighbor of doubt and trust eroding. So Bosnia didn't have to become Bosnia. That's the comment that I made in terms of ethno-sectarian essentialism. It didn't have to be that way. And one of the stories of our intervention there is a day late and a dollar short in our intervention, right? Rather, so Iraq could become Bosnia. It is on its way. I mean, I first saw the first reports of, I think the first report I saw of ethnic cleansing was down in the neighborhood down in Dura over a year ago, well before the Golden Mosque bombing. So I have been worried about that for a while. It could become that way. We need to, and so that's why I disagree with the Biddle communal war argument. Let's not jump to, because that at this time will drive it that way rather than mitigate it and prevent it. And, you know, we don't want a Bosnia-like solution in Iraq. So, no, I when I say it's not Bosnia, I'm saying it could very well become that, but it's not there yet.
Deborah Alexander. I've just returned, Dana, from a couple of years in Afghanistan, where I've been the senior advisor for democracy there with State Department. And so some of the questions, I have two quick questions for you, and probably has to do with the fact that I haven't been here in Washington for a while. But much of what you described, particularly with the problems of process and not being process-focused, as you know, USAID is our federal agency that's in charge of developing our democratization programs. So my question is, what should USAID be doing differently in what you've talked about? Because I think many of the issues that you talked about we also had in Afghanistan, of course. And then the second question is a part of this, and that is, Again, some of the issues that you discussed, we went through in Bosnia and Kosovo and other places where we have been involved in state building and institution building, regime change and other phrases that we want to use, political reconstruction. Why is it that we continue not to learn the lessons?
It's nice to see you again. I think the last time I saw you was like in 1997 in the OSCE building in... okay. An awful lot of what I understand about these processes are things that I've learned from the people within USAID who do development processes. I mean, because in some respects, what I'm saying is we have to pay attention to development processes. Now, there are a couple of challenges with USAID, and it comes from where it is bureaucratically. USAID went through a horrible downsizing and has gone through 20 years of trying to convince people that its job is not to give money away to foreign governments that don't spend it very well. I mean, USAID does the opposite of that. There are other aid agencies do direct transfer. USAID gets beat up overseas for not doing direct transfer. It is very defensive about saying, look, we're doing good things and documenting it. And so it's become slightly very bureaucratic in terms of going, you know, I've got my $5 million, I'm going to Bolivia, I'm showing you I'm doing good things. And yet and it doesn't think like DOD. If you look at DOD in the Cold War, DOD resource arguments in the Cold War basically were, look at all the commies over there. Count them. Look at them. My God, we need a pile of money. Give us a big pile of money or the commies are going to come get us. I mean, it was slightly more refined than that, but not a whole lot. And what it did was it said, look, there is a big problem over there. If you want to stop a big problem, we need big piles of money. AID as a bureaucratic culture goes, no, trust us. I mean, we spent our $5 million in Bolivia to bring democracy to Bolivia really, really well, even though the basic idea that you were going to have a measurable impact on Bolivian democracy with $5 million, it's nowhere near enough, right? I mean, USAID is not Jesus. It doesn't turn loaves and fishes into feeding the millions. It's a very good organization. It's not that good. And so the first thing, and the other thing it's very defensive about, is politics, right? Because what gets you in trouble faster than anything in AID, in the history of AID, is normally getting involved in the politics of the country and getting PNG'd out of, you know, obscurabi someplace because you actually did something that generated. Now, but development, which is really politics in slow motion, right? It's very slow, long-term social change. When you put it into a situation like Nepal or Iraq or any place where you're doing conflict mitigation, you can't do politics in slow motion because politics is way too fast in those environments. So AID as an organization has to I think, be to use its expertise, rebuild its expertise, develop its expertise, and help the world understand what development is, and then get ahead of the problem and go, yeah, you want to build democracy in Iraq, we actually know how to do it. Satellite TV, it's neighborhood meetings, it's ministry meetings, it's all of this. Here's how we're going to do it. It's going to take you five years. It's going to cost you, you know, $5 billion, but we're going to do it. I mean, so AID, I think, really needs to trust in its own expertise and get ahead of the problem. Why don't we learn? Because we're human beings. I know it's very frustrating. I think there are we actually do learn. And I think one of the things that we have to do is pay as much attention now to learning how to build peace as we've paid to learning how to fight wars for the past 25,000 years, 250,000, I was thinking, since Thucydides, right? You look and you stack all the books on the Civil War up, and then stack, that is just the Civil War of the United States up, and compare them to all the books that have written about building peace. And we have to put that problem at the center. And I think that's a recognition we are coming to. I think the other thing is, I mean, there are learning moments, right? There are, And one of the reasons, I think one of the things we have to do now is take the lessons from Iraq and generalize them and learn from them, because everybody's brain is open. Everybody is asking questions. I mean, you could go to Pete Chiarelli in Baghdad right now, three-star corps commander there, I guarantee his brain is so open that if you've got a solution that you think will actually help his troops on the ground, how much money does it take? What do we have to do? What do you want from me? I mean, the military in particular is spectacularly open to learning right now. We really have a learning moment.
Okay. My name is Siraj Ali Amin with the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. I was actually, before I did this, I was an army officer and I was in Iraq for 5 months in the town of Mosul. Nice little neighborhood. I'd recommend everyone going, just not now. And my father's in Saudi Arabia, but it gets better. I actually did want to mention a point, something that I saw, if I could share my experiences from, almost a year ago. But when I was up in Mosul, one thing that I think you mentioned very well, Doctor, was that we do make it easier for the bad guys to dislike us. I mean, a lot of people walk around and ask, oh, why do they hate us? Well, there are a lot of reasons why, but some of the major reasons that I saw were, just as an example, we have these vehicles in Iraq called Strikers, an SBCT, which stands for Striker Brigade Combat Team, you know this, but they're these really excellent vehicles, very armored, and they have wheels, and, you know, they go places, and problem is, if you're standing in front of one of these things and it's going, you know, 30 miles an hour and it doesn't stop, it's going to be really ugly for you. And that happens with Iraqis a pretty fair amount. Like if there's a situation where a soldier has to decide whether to move forward and accidentally kill someone and save all his guys, or the opposite, lose his man, you know, naturally he's going to go forward. But the system that's in place now is giving people money, you know, sort of blood money. But again, this is something that I was talking to people about when I was over there. We fail to understand the culture. Like, there's this concept in the Middle East called athar, which means revenge. It's an old word. It's an old concept. I mean, if you kill someone's kid and you give them money, they're not going to forget about it. They're going to use that money to wage war against you in order to extract revenge for the crime you committed against them. So, I mean, that was something that I noticed, and I think it's something that we are just missing tremendously, and it's hurting. But I was wondering if you came across experiences like that yourself, or if you had done any research.
I completely agree. I mean, I think one of the things that we have to recognize, as I said, we have the damage done by Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right, which is this very simple notion that people progress up a ladder of needs only when their lower needs are met. People have very complex structures of needs and are profoundly emotional, and dynamics of reconciliation and revenge and stuff like that are absolutely central. And that's, there's a whole other layer to what I'm trying to do, which is later work, in which we have to figure out how to address those dynamics at a social and at a cultural level. It's an incredibly difficult problem, and it's a much easier problem to avoid than it is to get out of once you're in it. So I don't have any answers for you. I have some experiences and some awarenesses in terms of how to handle those things. But I've seen some of those things. You're exactly right. I think that's the only thing I'll just say.
Thank you.
Thank you. By the way, there's a scene like that in the film War Tapes, where the truck hits a civilian. Okay, I'm Diane Perlman. I'm a member of the Transcend Network of Conflict Transformation, which was founded by Johan Galtung, who had conceptualized the OSCE, by the way, and also a member of the fellow in the Solomon Asch Center for the Study of Ethnopolitical Conflict. And first of all, it's very refreshing to hear a social scientist, and I'm personally committed. I'm a psychologist, clinical and political, and I'm committed to developing a collaboration of social scientists to contribute to designing policy based on sound principles that could work. So thank you for that. So I have two questions based on that. One is that I've been developing a process online of interdisciplinary collaboration from experts in the field of conflict studies on a strategy for Iraq. And one of the things that came up was a suggestion of a division into three districts. And, you know, I hear Iraqis say we're one country. I hear different things on it. So then I sent out sort of round two to people, what do people think about this? And I got back some feedback that there's research that it actually reduces violence when they do some kind of confederation. Also the comment of this Iraqi woman over here of her experience, the primary thing being reducing violence and tension reduction. I know they're complicated issues, so I want to know what you think about that. And my second question is that a lot of the solutions or suggestions are within a military paradigm, like stand up, stand down, different militias. And I guess people in these fields of study are into, like, transformation and, say, less need for violence, satisfying just grievances, and if you maybe some of the hierarchy of, like, identity, dignity, sovereignty, less fear, and all that, that you would have less need for militia and can replace war and violence with other things. So what do you think about that?
If I can just interrupt, I think it might be a good idea, since we're getting close to the to 2 o'clock, if we could just collect the rest of the questions, and if you could then respond to whatever you think is most important in that period of time. I think we've got 2 more people left in the back. There's 2 of you. I don't know if there's anybody else in the front who wanted to ask questions. So if we can just have the 3 of you, and then we'll end at 2. Okay? Let's start with you in the...
Hello, my name is Joe Michaels, and I'm interning at the Senate. And I was wondering, you said in your presentation that a true democracy at least takes a strong tradition of democracy and learning democratic principles and things like that. And certainly America had a long tradition of that. And India, another example, had a tradition not of mostly participating in democracy during the British occupation, but at least viewing British participation in their own democracy with people living there. So, and also one of the key ingredients of a true democracy is like a perception of fairness, where even though like certain people vote and voice their ideas and those ideas aren't chosen as a way to move forward, they at least have a perception of fairness that their ideas were heard fairly, and so they don't resort to violence as an alternative. So I was wondering, taking all that into consideration, do you think that there will have to be that long duration of a process of building traditions rather than simply building the correct institutions and leaving? And, I mean, like the president says that we're going to have to be in there for the long haul, but he's probably suggesting something around 10 to 15 years at the most. But do you think even that is a misconception of how long we need to be there? Do you think that to build those traditions, the American presence has to be not only heavy-handed, but there for a very long time to create these habits?
Okay, thank you. If we can hear from the last gentleman and then the lady over on the side.
My name is Brian Murphy. Thank you, Dr. Iyer, for your very, very incisive analysis. I spent some 14 months in Iraq in 3 different jobs as a USAID contractor with the CPA Ministry of Justice and finally with the Reconstruction Management Office of the U.S. Embassy. Just to comment, if I might, my great sadness about my experiences in Iraq stem from the lack of my understanding and that of, frankly, most of my colleagues about some of the cultural sensitivities to which some of our colleagues have adverted. We have made a tough situation very much more difficult by not understanding what happens when you take a striker and run down a child or do some of the other things that we do too often. There was a culture of violence during the 14 months that I was in Baghdad. Even, forgive me, the women who were security officers would wear with great pride their Glocks on their thighs, became a sex symbol, frankly, in the palace. And everybody that I worked with 1 or 2 exceptions, sat at their desks with their pistol while they worked at their half-size desk. And this doesn't win the peace. This is a culture of violence. I'm sure some of it's changed. But I think what you've shared with us today helps me at least understand more fully what some of these sensitivities are. And I thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. And our final question. If you can speak loudly or perhaps I could rephrase.
Okay. Well, I'll go over here. Just as long as I don't have to move them. Thank you, Dana. My question is regarding one of the first things you said, which is we need a new theory of warfare before we're going to see any institutional organizational change in the sort of a rational division of labor in our agencies and in our policies. My name is Lorelei Kelly. I've worked on Congress for the last 9 years on these exact issues. And one of the things I'd like to ask you is we've both worked a lot with the Army and with the military, especially military academics. I'm not sure, and yet, as you mentioned, the institutional memory of what our future is in the Army right now, and the Marines to some extent. And they're really good at a lot of this, and they're raising these generations of cadets who like this and see this as a theory of warfare. Is the Army ever going to want to give it back? is one question, and I have real conflicts over this. I have friends at West Point that we go back and forth of this, because right now there's still this huge fossil shelf of institutions in the military, but certainly in Congress and invested interests and in the status quo that just hate this stuff, want it to go away, and might do the same thing as after Vietnam, which is banish people like you, sociologists, from talking about new theories of warfare. So I'm wondering, is the Army going to give this up? And is that a good or bad thing?
Okay, thank you. Dr. Aaron, if you could take about a minute or at most 2 minutes.
So to Diane, yes. Maslow first published the hierarchy of needs in 1943. It's a rather old theory, so I'm entirely supportive of generating more attention to social science and thinking it through. We don't have very many answers, but we have a lot of good questions and we have a lot of insights. And so I completely agree with that effort. I think we need to do an awful lot of work about, I mean, the peace studies community needs to do peace studies within itself and with the military. We need to get out of bimodal either-or thinking, because, frankly, at a practical level, you know, when you're out there and there are people whose absolute full intent is to blow the brains out of somebody who wants to empower women and start a democracy, it's very difficult to talk. So we've got to find a way of thinking long-term, thinking short-term, thinking about the defensive and limited roles of military and how to integrate. I mean, so there's a huge amount of work that we need to do. For Joe, the short answer is, I mean, you know, it took Isaac Newton a long time to invent calculus. Luckily enough, if I want to learn it, I will learn it faster than if I have to invent it myself. I think there are a lot that yes, it does take time, and yes, it is cultural change, but it is not impossible to do democratization, particularly not if one respects and identifies the cultural change processes. We do need to be there, but what does we mean? Well, it doesn't necessarily have to mean the United States of America. It means to be representatives of the community of democracies, and be there does not necessarily have to mean run the place with guns, so that there is a long-term engagement process that is absolutely critical. It can be done. Brian, thank you very much. The Quienes Mas Macho game there, I think the peace studies community can help us address that issue. It's a gendered thing, which is a very important component on this that I haven't even addressed. It's a real problem, because you have to approach this work not as I've got the guns and I've got the answers, but as I've got a set of questions and we have to solve it together. And you're exactly right in the difficulty of that. Lorelei, the Iron Triangle problem, the institutional memory, will the Army give it back? I think I like Tom Barnett's work in terms of a long-term strategic vision. I tend to agree with his institutional solutions. I think there's an awful lot of work that we have to do in terms of structuring and helping the change process. We have to develop a development industrial social change complex to counteract, you know, the traditional Iron Triangle. So we have to do it.
I'd like to thank everyone for coming over on such a hot day. We have, as you can figure out, we have to end now because the Iraq Study Group will be meeting here at 2:30. Again, that's a closed session, so we'll have to ask everyone to leave the room now. And again, thank you for coming.